From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we speak with Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes about how the state can move toward racial equity. Then we look at the history of Milwaukee protests and how current movements can learn from our past.
The trouble was, when the violence ended, when it was quelled, there was a sense of victory, of order over chaos, rather than a wake-up call that something was seriously wrong and we had to address problems that were deep-seated.
Plus, how the Milwaukee Public Museum is adapting to a virtual experience due to the coronavirus pandemic.
Yes, it may not be the same in terms of tactile experiences, but I mean, I think that we will always be a museum where there are objects and specimens and things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to see in front of you, for sure.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. One of the biggest stories slated for Wisconsin in 2020 was the Democratic National Convention. But as we move closer to the convention date, it's one of the last things on the minds of many Wisconsinites, especially Milwaukeeans. People in Milwaukee and throughout the U.S. are continuing to march against police brutality, calling for justice, reforms, and accountability. And these protests centered on racial inequities are especially potent in Milwaukee, considered one of the most segregated cities in America. Since the beginning of his career, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes has focused on racial justice. As a Milwaukee native, Barnes says that people here are, quote, stepping up for good reason. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the protests and what it'll take to create statewide reforms.
Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking some time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So equity was a key point and goal of yours, along with sustainability, right after you and Governor Evers won the election. So in light of recent protests following the death of George Floyd in Minnesota, what are the key issues of equity that need to be addressed right now?
Well, that's the thing. They're the same issues. And addressing equity on the front end prevents things like this from happening. Making sure that communities are properly resourced, making sure that children have the same opportunity in all parts of our state. And that's not the reality right now. And it's certainly not the reality across the United States of America. Otherwise, you wouldn't see the response that you're seeing. And I remind people that the activity, the protest, even some of the more damaging aspects, which was a small minority of it, it's like volcanic activity. People have dealt with these extreme living conditions for far too long. And I think about elected leaders, a lot of people in office, especially our highest offices, who haven't experienced life in folks' shoes and in the shoes of marginalized people, be it poverty or be it color of skin. And so the ability to relate to what's going on isn't there. And that's why you don't see the response that you should be seeing. And I am very frustrated every day that I wake up and have to deal with the inaction of our state legislature, especially on the issues that are as pressing as this, the ones that are, you know, right in the forefront, and to see so many folks across the state of Wisconsin who are stepping up, who are coming out of their homes to protest injustice is something, is a sight to behold. And it's something that makes me very proud, because these are people who probably didn't think that issues of racial justice ever would impact them. And the issues probably still won't impact them, but it's too big to ignore at this point. I saw one person with a sign, I'm not sure if it was here in Wisconsin, but the sign just said, "I finally get it."
And what is the governor's office's role, including yours as lieutenant governor, for pushing for equity? And what's been done or will be done? You mentioned legislatures have yet to really move or make action.
Yeah, so we have to lead with equity in every decision that we make. And even the budget that was introduced was one that established equity in the forefront, and also, you know, sustainability. But that means that, you know, we need to put a little bit more money into early childhood programs, especially in our most challenged zip codes, like the 53206. The governor did that, making sure that we work to create opportunities for people, especially returning citizens, you know, and making the upfront investment so we don't have to spend as much money on incarceration to create job programs and to help small businesses. You know, there's so much, but it's tough to do it on our own. And that's not the way governing is supposed to happen anyway. And people can look at it as divided government, but it should be looked at as shared government. But that's not what we're getting right now. And it's not about what the executive branch is getting. It's what the people of the state are or are not getting. And, you know, the time for the partisan political games is long. That should be over with, because these aren't partisan issues. These are issues of life and death for people. And, you know, we're going to keep moving forward with everything we can do as far as executive authority. But there's still so much more that's left to be desired.
On Twitter, you said, quote, "We need to invest more in neighborhoods and community services. The more money we invest in opportunity for people, the less money we have to spend on police and prisons." So does this mean you're in favor of defunding police as a way of reform in policing? Evers has said that he doesn't believe defunding the police will work. But what's your opinion on that stance that people are calling for right now?
I think I made it pretty clear in that message, in that tweet, because the more money that we invest in our schools, the more money we invest in early childhood education, the more we invest in job programs and business creation programs in our most challenged parts of society, the less money we'll have to spend on incarceration, the less money we'll have to spend on policing. It's a conversation about budget prioritization, and we have to promote budgets that put people first. And in putting people first, you effectively work to create safer communities, places where people want to live and where people want to invest and where there is less of a need for police presence. So I think that, you know, my message is very clear there in saying that and saying what we need to do up front, what the immediate thing needs to be to address the crises that we're facing, to right the wrongs that we're dealing with.
But do you believe that taking money from overinflated police budgets should then be put towards other things and in that sense of defunding police?
Well, you can look at City of Milwaukee, for example, where 45% of the departmental allocations that goes to police, while you get, you know, libraries like 2 or 3%, neighborhood services 2 or 3%. You know, I think that you can look at that as a priorities mismatch. I think that if you look for, like, even in the federal government, you look at the bloated military budget. Even in state government, you look at the Department of Corrections budget, and, you know, this is our own administration, right? Like, you know, and this, it didn't start with us, and it's something that we're actively working to remedy. We're working to reduce our prison population. We are very intentional about making that happen, and it takes that intentionality. You know, and it's easy to look at a budget of a police department and say, well, yeah, we are spending a lot of money. How do we get smarter about this? And again, it becomes the conversation about needs. This isn't about attacking the police. If anything, it's about making their jobs easier by implementing you know, programs that where we'd have services where they wouldn't have to respond to things that aren't crimes, where they don't have to respond to you know, instances that would be better suited for a social worker or some sort of crisis intervener or a violence interrupter that would help, you know, promote peace in communities in the first place. I think that's where our funding should go, because, you know, what's going on right now isn't necessarily working. You know, police brutality is one thing, but in general, the idea of promoting safer communities, I don't think that we're doing a good job at that. And when I say we, I mean everybody in most offices across the country. There's so much more, and that's why I call on, you know, our local elected officials to think about the priorities. You know, think about what opportunity can mean for the communities and the districts that you represent. Think about what opportunity can mean for this entire state. And, you know, a world that sees much less violence, a world that experiences much more peace and much more harmony and, you know, interconnectivity between neighbors, between, you know, communities, that's possible. You know, you can look at it as some sort of, you know, pie in the sky dream, but it's absolutely possible. I think that the United States is one of the countries that has seen the most trouble because, you know, from our founding, it was a violent founding, and it only makes sense that there is still violence all these years later, 300, you know, years later, and we could be far better off. But it takes imagining. It takes people challenging their ideas, their perception of what society should look like.
So you are a Milwaukee native, and I'm curious, what was your and has been your personal reaction to the marches that have taken place here and continue to take place here in response to police brutality and a host of other issues?
People are stepping up for good reason. And I think that we have these and the thing about it, too, is, I mean, you just saw somebody get shot in Atlanta just a couple of days ago. But I think that what we're seeing also is a compounded crisis, where we have the pandemic and people are out of work, people aren't going back to school, and people have so many more grievances to be aired. And what COVID-19 did was expose a lot of the fissures, it exposed a lot of the societal flaws that we have, especially amongst race and class. And you see the most impacted people, those who are losing their lives at an inordinate rate. You know, these are Black and brown people, these are low-income individuals. And so when those sorts of societal failures are highlighted, when you have an instance where you have a George Floyd who, you know, died, you know, with his neck under the knee of a police officer while three others looked on, you have an Ahmaud Arbery who was killed by a vigilante while a person followed and filmed the instance, when, you know, and immediately you think this is someone who's trying to, you know, stop this from happening, but that person was a party to the crime. You see a Breonna Taylor who was sleeping in her home, you know, and she couldn't have been farther removed from any sort of crime at all. You know, you see these repeated instances and you sort of ask yourself, you know, how much more can you take? And the bigger question is, you know, why did it take so long for so many folks to ignore it? And like that person signs that I finally get it, I often think about people who haven't necessarily had to think about these things. They haven't had to think about racial injustice. They've gone through childhood, they've gone through school, adult life, and professional life, and they're still learning. And that confuses me, because, you know, you've made it this far in life without ever having to consider the plight of other people. And I think that is a bigger part of the problem, too, is that the issues of racial justice have been way too easy for folks to ignore. You know, and people have gotten pretty far in life without ever having to make those considerations. And, you know, that is a challenge I have for myself. I think about the injustices that many other communities deal with that I don't personally deal with, but I understand it, because as long as this injustice goes on towards, you know, communities, then we're all going to be in a bad place. And that is, and what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is everything coming to a head, and people aren't going to deal with it anymore. It's really a surprise that folks have dealt with it this long.
So in regards to racism as a public health crisis, Milwaukee County leaders declared it a public health crisis back in 2019, and currently we're seeing more city and county leaders across the U.S. officially doing the same. So would you have any plans to move to make it a statewide declaration? Because as you mentioned, most people don't think about it as that way, and they don't live that experience. But if the state played a role in declaring it a public health crisis, that could potentially help influence funding and policy.
Yeah, whether formal or not, it's something that I carry around all the time. I talk about issues of racial injustice and how it is a detriment to how it impedes our state's ability to thrive. You know, when I'm in Milwaukee, I find myself talking about number of rural issues. When I'm in more rural areas, I find myself talking about more Milwaukee and diverse issues, because I want to make sure that I'm doing everything I can do to bridge those gaps, to start some conversations, to begin dialogue, to start the process of understanding for people who just may not get it. And there are some well-intentioned people who just don't get it. There are some people who actively don't get it, who try their best to avoid it and will gaslight the American public into thinking that this isn't a real problem. But there are a lot of people who truly want to be better, but just don't know how. I actually received a message from a person in the western part of the state, and I don't know how to respond to it. I don't know how my office is going to respond to it yet. But it's a person who reached out in earnest and said that he has you know, his own issues that he's dealing with. And, you know, he talked about having this Black neighbor that he used to talk to about these things. And, you know, since then, that neighbor has died. So he said that he doesn't have that outlet anymore. But he feels a certain sense of nervousness around youth of color, right? But he reached out not to say that he thinks they're doing anything wrong. He just doesn't know what to do. He just doesn't know how to approach it. So there are, you know, there are some people like that who legitimately, you know, are looking for, you know, the best way to go about things, who want to do the right thing, but just don't know. And that's a process that, you know, government can't necessarily fix. You know, that's an issue that society has to fix, but in many ways you see society working to fix itself. You know, like I've mentioned before, the people who are standing up to protest, these aren't folks who are showing up because they want things to get worse. They're showing up because they want to save the nation from cascading in a complete and total devastation.
Racial justice has been a focus of your entire career, and the protests that have spread around the world show the reactions of a blatant disregard of Black lives. And you mentioned being not quite sure of how to respond to the person who reached out to you. And there's a lot of fatigue in the Black community that you can personally attest to. So how fatigued are you, and what, if anything, helps you remain hopeful, especially in your role as Lieutenant Governor?
Yeah, and I'll start by saying that, you know, racial justice has been an issue for my entire working life, but there have been so many other issues, right? Like, I think about issues like jobs and economic development, education, you know, prison reform, environmental issues, all those things, right? And addressing one doesn't take any focus or energy away from the other, but it doesn't feel that way when I talk to other people that, you know, you can prioritize your issue, yes, but that doesn't mean disregard the other ones that are going on. It's always like, you know, we'll get to the racial justice one later. We'll get to the racial justice issue. Oh, this isn't the time to talk about that. This isn't the part of the state to talk about that. This isn't the campaign to talk about that. But for a lack of talking about it is why we are where we are now. And the fatigue that does exist, because there definitely is a fatigue, because you feel like you talk about this stuff forever, and I can go back to folks who still, you know, want to be educated, people who've gone on to be very successful in life and now are like crowdsourcing their views on society by leaning on people who've been through the most to educate them about something that they probably could have taken a little more time to pay attention to, but chose not for whatever reason. And, I just want to encourage people to, you know, be better when it comes to that. Think about before you ask your friends of color, before you ask your Black friend, can you help me be better? Like, think about how is it that you got this far without ever having to worry about it, and think about how tired, some of your Black friends could be in a moment such as this, because there's no off switch. A lot of people will go home, relax, chill out once it's, you know, wake up in the day and they, you know, send some tweets and go to a march, which is great. You know, do everything you can do to, you know, talk to your family. There's so many things that people can do, and I'm not here to admonish anyone for trying. But I do want to remind people that for a lot of leaders who experience and live this daily, whether in elected office or not, it's a bit much. It can be a lot, but we're called to leadership, and this is the work that has to happen, and this is one of the reasons why I got elected, to make sure that we're leading with our best self, that we're doing everything that we can do to build safe, happy, healthy, and inclusive societies, not just here in Wisconsin, but all across the country. I know it's possible, and I think that's sort of what keeps me going, that ridiculous hope, that ridiculous optimism, that things can be better.
Well, and what are you doing to take care of yourself during such demanding times?
I exercise, that helps. Been doing a little bit of yoga, video games here and there, and I eat a lot of food. I eat so much food.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Mandela Barnes is the Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The Lieutenant Governor is just one of many politicians who have joined us here on Lake Effect to talk about the many issues facing our community today. And these conversations are only brought to air because of listeners like you, who put their money where their hearts are. Community-based, mission-driven public radio. This is WUWM's one-day member drive, and you can donate by calling 414-227-3210. You can go online at wuwm.com/give or use the WUWM app and click that big red donate button. Coming up, we'll be joined by historian John Gerda to look at Milwaukee's long history of protesting. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The recent protests here in Milwaukee have drawn a lot of comparisons with the civil rights protests of the 1960s. Most notably, in 1967 through 1968, activists marched for 200 consecutive nights to protest the city's fair housing standards. But the city's relationship with protesting extends back much farther than the 1960s, to the city's very foundation. And in some cases, these movements have led to real systemic changes that speak to the soul of the city. Historian John Gerda has written extensively about Milwaukee's past, and he joins me to talk about how protest movements have shaped the city. John Gerda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure, Joy.
So I think Milwaukee natives will be familiar with this kind of infamous story, but I think it really highlights how integral protesting and demonstrations of sorts are really a part of the fabric of this city. The Milwaukee Bridge War. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. The city was founded by three guys who didn't get along very well. You had Solomon Juneau on the east side, Byron Kilburn on the west side, and George Walker on the south side. And you have the first bridge was built across the Milwaukee River back in 1840. And the west siders suffered in silence for a while, but then one warm night in 1845, the west siders took axes and hatchets to their side of the bridge, collapsed it into the Milwaukee River, and it floated downstream kind of stately fashion, blocked traffic going north. And the east siders wake up in the morning to find they can't get off out to the west, so they react by cutting off the west side's bridges to the south. So for a while, no one could get anywhere. And you actually had, you know, there was not much of a police department back then. You actually had blood being shed for the greater honor or in glory of the east and west sides, especially. The south side was more non-combatant. But yeah, there was the Milwaukee Sentinel had a great line, sort of. A number of the people involved in that rivalry were considerably injured, though not seriously.
It sounds, in retrospect, very Starbelly Sneetches.
Yeah, yeah. Or toast buttered on upside down, up downside. Yeah. Same sort of thing. There was more at stake there. You know, what was going on was the West Side was trying to deny the East Side access to the rest of the world to promote its own economic fortunes. So they were trying to attract settlers and business to their side, especially Byron Kilbourne. He was not a man who played well with others.
Well, and it seems like there's a period of time where Milwaukee was considered a bit lawless. There was a lynching in the Third Ward. There was also a banking riot in the same year, 1861, so a couple decades after the Bridge War. Mm-hmm. How common were these kinds of uprisings at the founding of the city?
Relatively common, and it was by no means something that was unique to Milwaukee. You know, this was out in the frontier, and it wasn't quite, you know, shootouts at the OK Corral, but there was a kind of a rather impotent law enforcement system compared to what it became in later years. At one point, you have, you know, there were Irish, the Irish lynched an African-American, you know, who was involved in a knife fight with an Irishman. Around the same time, there were Germans, you know, who were rioting in the streets around the same period. And the police department was kind of powerless. They were outnumbered. That bank riot you're talking about back in 1861, you have the sheriff, you have the mayor. They kind of came up, tried to tried to soothe the crowd, and someone threw a brick, and you know, they realized they were outnumbered, so they beat a hasty retreat. Also recall, back in those years and for a long time thereafter, and this goes into the 20th century, I had a great uncle who was ended up being the first Polish captain of the Burnham Avenue precinct on the south side. And when he came up and through the ranks, resisting arrest was not something that you'd be prosecuted for. An officer had to beat a suspect in a fair fight and haul him off to jail before he could be actually apprehended and enter the criminal justice system. So yes, it was, you know, it was a much, much wilder and woolier time than ours.
You know, we look even just a couple decades after that, we move into a part of our history that people are a little bit more familiar with and that bears a lot of resemblance to what we're seeing now. There were these labor protests in the city, which ultimately lead to a pretty grisly massacre. Tell us a bit about that moment in our city's history.
The year was 1886, and during those years in Milwaukee and nationally, if you worked in a factory, you were working at least 10 hours a day, often 12 hours a day, and you were working 6 days a week. So the weekends were one day long. It was Sunday. And there was no workers' compensation. There was no health insurance, no paid time off for anything. So it really was an extraordinarily severe system. So not surprisingly, labor organized early and often. And under the leadership of a national union called the Knights of Labor, Milwaukee and Chicago became the two main centers of agitation for the eight-hour day without a cut in pay. That was the primary cause they were after. And to make a long story short, there was a general strike that shut down the city on May 1st. There were gangs, crowds of protesters, strikers marching around the city, closing other major employers. The last one open was the Bayview Rolling Mill on the southeast side. The morning of May 5th, a crowd of roughly 1,500 strikers, many of them Polish, marched from Mitchell Street, St. Stanislaus Church, and when they got to the mill, they found the militia waiting for them. And these were, in many cases, their neighbors and countrymen, kind of the early version of the National Guard. At a distance of roughly 200 yards, the militia opened fire, killing seven people, including a 13-year-old schoolboy who was playing hooky and a retired mill worker who was watching from his backyard. It was the bloodiest labor disturbance in Wisconsin's history and broke the back of the eight-hour movement, but at the same time really galvanized the working class to organize politically. They put together something called the People's Party in the very next election and swept the offices. And that was in many ways kind of a catalyst for the movement that we come to know as socialism, you know, which became the dominant party in 1910, you know, that landslide that put the first social administration into office in any American city.
In researching this, it did seem like these protests were largely peaceful. I mean, any amount of rioting is going to lead to some problems, some property damage, mm-hmm. certainly. Why did they fire on them?
Because back in those years, it was the day after the Haymarket riot down in Chicago, so there were extraordinarily high tensions. But what it came down to, basically, was the governor, Jeremiah Rusk, said that this was an insurrection that had to be put down. He actually said, fire on them. So it was from very high up. You know, this was a peaceful protest. It was to be met with violence. And not that the strikers were above throwing rocks and you know, dead chickens and other kinds of refuse at the militia, but you know, they were not using deadly force. So it was, to many people, it was a really chilling illustration that industrial property was valued more highly than industrial workers. So it was a time when people began to kind of radically rethink, you know, how they wanted their city and their state run. And that's where socialism came from. You know, it was very much a worker-oriented movement.
Yeah. Well, not long after that protest and those demonstrations, there was an event I found that seemed to have, again, a lot of parallels to things that we've seen today. It's mm-hmm. called the Smallpox Riot of 1894. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard about it before.
And it's been kind of buried, but it's a really interesting episode in Milwaukee's history. Back in those years, you know, there were contagious diseases of virulence and a variety that really overwhelm anything we're doing today, even the pandemic. You know, the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic pandemic was worse than COVID-19. So in some ways, we've kind of gone back to the way things had been earlier in Milwaukee's and the world's history. But smallpox, it was deadly. You know, there were vaccines for it, but there was an isolation hospital that was put on Milwaukee's south side, and that was considered a seat of pestilence by the neighbors. And you had a very autocratic health commissioner, a guy named Kempster, and they were actually taking infected kids out of their homes and taking them to the isolation hospital, which, as you can imagine, was just a red flag for the mothers, especially. This was a woman-led disturbance. You have these riots in the streets, and the embarrassed policemen found it difficult to kind of strike an unarmed woman. So it was there's some very interesting kind of gender things playing out here. But it was something that was kind of a low point of Milwaukee's public health experience, and things quickly got better. You know, during the 1918 epidemic, the Spanish flu, you know, Milwaukee was just a model of measures to fight and prevent the spread of that virus. We were among the healthiest cities in the country at that point.
Yeah. When we look at kind of where we are today, it's interesting to compare it to how we responded to the 1918 pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you think about, they did not say social distancing, but that's just what they were doing. You know, they closed the churches, the movie theaters, the legitimate theaters, and the saloons. They didn't close those, but you couldn't loiter. You could get a drink and go out outside and kind of go on your merry way. So the closing of saloons in Milwaukee would have been that would have been a very radical step. So the result was, that the rates of infection slowed here compared to other cities, especially out east. And they came back. This is the end of the last quarter of 1918, just before Christmas. You know, there was a resurgence of cases in November, so they had to put the restrictions in place again, and they were not lifted until December 25th. So, and even then, this is kind of reminiscent of, reminds us of what's going on now. New Year's Eve parties were held in December 31st of 1918. But if you were outside of the public dance, you had to wear a triple or maybe six layers of gauze mask. So people were masked up in public then. And one newspaper reporter said that the dance looked like, from the neck up, people looked like they were holding up a bank. So it's a kind of a visual that is pretty familiar to us in 2020.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm talking right now with historian John Gerda. So, we touched on the cities. I believe that the only known lynching of an African-American person in the city's history, which happened at a time when there really wasn't a large Black community in the area. But as we move into the 1940s, that starts to change with the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. And there were some growing pains. What did that look like?
Absolutely. There were fewer African-Americans in Milwaukee back in those years, but there was racism. You know, that's part of the legacy of slavery and just the treatment of African-Americans from the very beginning of their history in this country, way back in the early decades of the 1600s. After you have, the Great Migration increases the number of African-Americans in Milwaukee from hundreds to thousands by 1950 or so, you were up in a fairly appreciable size. At the same time, it was not until 1970, that Milwaukee was rose out of last place in its concentration or proportion of African Americans. So this was very much a recent phenomenon. So it was later, certainly, than it happened in Chicago, but the growth of the Black community, as you have in the North Side, kind of moving north and west, they moved into the old German neighborhoods, and it was like oil and water. So you have, there weren't race riots like there were in Chicago back in the 20s, but there certainly was a great deal of resistance and a great deal of flight, you know, in those years after, just after World War II, and a whole lot of unpleasantness, you know, just people being made to feel they were not welcome. And they had to live someplace. You know, you have this natural expansion as people came up here for jobs. So Milwaukee also resisted public housing for a very long time. You know, the first project was Hillside Terrace, didn't open until after World War II. And that was Frank Zeidler, a socialist who very much believed that all should have the right to decent housing. But others, the property owners, rental owners especially, kind of resisted that because one came right out and said, you know, the only reason that there aren't more blacks here is that we don't have enough housing, and they wanted to keep it that way. So there was, you know, certainly an entrenched systemic racism that people are, in just recent weeks, have become more aware of, but it's part of our heritage as a city and a country.
Well, and as we look into our history, I think people are going to be familiar with a lot of the protests of the 1960s, especially the Fair Housing marches. But mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn just how multifaceted the movements were at that time. What were some of the groups that were involved in protests at the time, and what were the different issues that they were hoping to change?
In terms of civil rights, the beginning there was school desegregation, and that's a time when they were called it intact busing. In the overcrowded schools in the black community on the north side, they would bus whole busloads of kids out to classrooms in not full, you know, places that had place available in white neighborhoods, and then take them back at the end of the day. It was just open and shut racist. That was one issue. Another was the Eagles Club, which had a lot of judges among its membership, had a Caucasians-only membership policy. Those protests took place in, I think, 66, 67. And then open housing, you know, became the major kind of the flashpoint for a lot of the marches in Milwaukee for about 200 consecutive nights. And around the same time, you know, this really was, you know, it's when I came of age, you have the anti-war movement is going on at the same time. So the summer of 1967 was both the high point of the open housing marches and also the summer of love, where you have the beginnings of Viennes and Lake Park happenings, as well as a lot of disturbances whose epicenter was the Water Tower Park, you know, right in front of what's now Columbia St. Mary's Hospital. And that was, it got fairly unpleasant. There was police intervention there as well. But people were marching because if you lost your college deferment or weren't in college in the first place, no, you were getting sent to Vietnam. So it was a war that was more and more unpopular and drew more and more protests as those years went on. So it really was, you talk about multifaceted, you know, it really was. That was just a wild summer. And that went on, you know, until the 1970s when the campuses shut down. So till we pulled out in 1975. So there was certainly a great deal more turmoil than we even, you know, think of today. And then obviously in the middle of all that, you have the riot of 67, or you have the things that were going on the north side around 3rd Street, King Drive. You know, there were quite like what was going on in Lake Street in Minneapolis just in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, the anti-war movement continued on into the 70s, and the issues with racial inequity in the city of Milwaukee have continued really since 1960s. Mm-hmm. There have been protests, demonstrations in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, you know, up until where we are right now. What mm-hmm. are some of the larger demonstrations that we've seen in our more recent history?
Boy, the Ernest Lacey was shot by the police. That's earlier, so there were protests there. Howard Fuller, the former school superintendent and educational activist, was the leader of that movement. You have in the 2016, you have the protest over the shooting of Sylville Smith. You know, that shooting led to unrest in Sherman Park, and in between, I can't think of flashpoints that would have been as dramatic as those.
There's one name that I might add, Dontre Hamilton. Did you say Dontre Hamilton?
No, I didn't. You're right. That's Yeah, this is a repeating scenario. But I think the bottom line is that you have that conflagration in 1967 and martial law, Henry Meyer taking a firm hand that kind of put it down. The trouble was, and I think this was a national problem, was that when the violence ended, when it was quelled, there was a sense of victory, of order over chaos, rather than a wake-up call that something was seriously wrong and we had to address the problems that were deep-seated and had been around since the founding of the Republic. What seems different about the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020 is that there is a broader acknowledgement nationally, that this is something that we've had in our system for a long time and we need to get rid of it. And I find that certainly refreshing. Right now, obviously, we're right in the middle of it. And, my hope is that it doesn't become another case of, platitudes and sloganeering and we go back to business as usual. That there is some motion to address some of the underlying issues that affect and afflict this society.
Yeah. Well, John Gerda, thank you for taking the time out to look back at Milwaukee's history and our demonstrating roots.
Yeah, my pleasure, Joy. And that's always the case. We always think that what we are experiencing in the present is the first time ever. And it is certainly, but at the same time, it's not. This is kind of a durable human experience, and we've been at it for a very long time.
Historian John Gerda is the author of many books, including The Making of Milwaukee and Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. You can find more of our conversations with Gerda at WUWM.com. And while you're there, you can donate to our one-day member drive. You can also call us at 414-227-3210 or tap the red donate button on the WUWM app. As we just heard from John Gerda, we're living through a profoundly historic moment. We're in the middle of a pandemic that has transformed our communities. There's an incredibly contentious election on the horizon, and protests have broken out in cities around the country, including Milwaukee. And good reporting has never been more vital to understanding what's happening. When you donate to WUWM, you're saying that facts matter. The number to call is 414-227-3210. You can head to wuwm.com/give or tap that red donate button on the WUWM app. We'll take a short break now, then take a virtual tour of the Milwaukee Public Museum when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Many organizations are finding new ways to engage with the public during this pandemic. Like most places, the Milwaukee Public Museum has remained closed. But a new partnership with Google is allowing people back inside the museum without leaving their homes. One of Google Maps' best-known features is called Street View, which allows people to zoom in on a location and see on-the-ground photos. Now you can do the same with the Public Museum's Streets of Old Milwaukee or its Living Ocean exhibits. Jenny Tetzloff is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Director of Integrated Marketing, and she joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain more about the project. She begins by explaining how the partnership between the museum and Google began.
Our Director of Electronic Systems and Information, Greg Post, has been in contact with Google since 2014, actually, to get this up and running. And Google came out and they took some photos, and then there was, I guess, some sort of technical glitch on that end. So they came back out just as we were wrapping up our Hidden Wisconsin exhibit, which was a temporary exhibit we did in 2016, 2017. So we were able to get that photographed. And Greg has been working with them to do a lot of different things regarding the museum, and he has been able to push this forward. Once we closed, he got back to them and said, hey, it would be really great. You know, I know we have these photos and we've been going back and forth, but it would be great for the community to be able to see everything while we're closed. And he was able to push that forward.
So you mentioned Google was coming and taking photographs. Can you explain the technical process? Was it, you know, we think of Google Street View satellite images as the car with the big 360 camera going around. So what did it look like to capture the museum in this way?
So they did have three staff members from Google come out with photographers, and they took pictures of everything kind of in a 360 kind of way. And they were able to get a lot of our photos and put those together on their end in the technical way, so to speak.
You mentioned there was a Hidden Wisconsin exhibit in 2016 that we could view right now. Are there any other exhibits or things that were at the museum previously during this time that we can now see today that we wouldn't be able to had museum operations been in normal circumstances?
No, for the most part, many of our exhibits are still the same as they were in 2016, but the Hidden Wisconsin exhibit is really cool because it has a lot of different artifacts and objects and specimens from all over Wisconsin that we don't usually have out, either because they are too fragile to be out or they're used mainly for research purposes. And so it's really nice that the community can come back and see those artifacts and specimens and look at them.
On the note of artifacts and specimens, I know a lot of your collection is vastly in storage. So during this time, have you been able to really go through all of the artifacts and kind of regroup and see what you have, what the public hasn't seen, and use this time in a way that will still serve the museum even though people can't come in the doors?
Yes. Our curatorial team has been able to go in, and we always have to manage collections. There are certain temperatures and certain standards that you have to meet. And so our curatorial team is full of amazing people who have been in the museum on and off. I mean, for the most part, most of us are working from home, but they do go in to check specimens. We do have security on staff, making sure that if anything should happen, they can get out and make sure that all of those objects and artifacts and specimens are safe.
So what are the most important aspects of a strategy that you had to develop in order to adapt to the coronavirus, you know, and what other ways are you engaging with visitors during this time?
For us, I would say that the most important thing that we've been doing is really moving into digital resources. So what we started to do is our education team and our curatorial team and a bunch of our other teams have come together, and we have created a weekly newsletter that we send out to people that gives activities that you can do for both children and adults. It highlights different collections. Some of them are on exhibit, but as you said, many of our collections are not on exhibit. And so some of them highlights things that you can't even see, and really moving into the digital realm, be it in, you know, video format. We're going to be doing a breakfast with the curators video. So that's really exciting. And just moving into a digital format so that we can still stay in touch with the community and make sure that they are getting access to really what is their collections.
So down the road, when time does come to reopen, you know, how have you been planning for that? You know, how will the experience for people be different? And I imagine you're working with city and county and health officials to find out the best way to go about things. So what has been at the forefront of your mind and in your planning?
So we do have a reopening committee that has been working with not only other museums in Wisconsin, but also with city and county and state health officials to make sure that everything is safe. I can't really say what that experience is going to look like yet, because we're still working through all those processes. And when we can open our doors, I can promise it's going to be a very safe experience for everyone, and you're still going to be able to enjoy all of the objects and exhibits that you've come to enjoy. It'll be a little different, but we're going to make sure it's as smooth as it can possibly be, and definitely the safety of our visitors and our staff is really important to us.
You know, I think fondly upon the time I've been able to go to the museum, whether it's through school or with family, and with that experience just on hold for a little bit, you know, what's one exhibit or perhaps a favorite object of yours that you can recommend to us to look for while taking a virtual tour online?
Well, for me, I love the Crossroads of Civilization exhibit that is on the third floor. We opened that in 2015. We have a Cleopatra coin that I always think is really kind of cool. It's like one of the first female leaders. She has her face on currency, and she's being a strong woman. So I enjoy that one.
Being able to step in front of an artifact such as that, you know, is a crucial point of that museum experience, right? But, you know, do you think museums will have to change the classic brick and mortar model as we adapt from this pandemic? And, you know, it's hard, obviously hard to tell what's going to happen in the future, but now there needs to be a lot of other plans in place, a lot of other measures at the ready.
Sure, but I do think that for museums, like objects and specimens and artifacts are a big part of what we do. And so, like, I cannot foresee a future where those items are never going to be at the forefront, because we all have the internet now. We can all go on and look at a picture of something that you can see somewhere else, but there's a different experience when it's directly in front of you. Yes, it may not be the same in terms of tactile experiences and touching. I don't know what that's going to look like yet, but I mean, I think that we will always be a museum where there are objects and specimens and things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to see in front of you, for sure.
So I know the museum also had a plan in place to build and move to a new space. Obviously, the pandemic disrupts things greatly on all fronts. So do you think this will still be able to happen at some point in the future? What's the museum's goal in working towards that?
Absolutely. They are still moving forward with that initiative. And, you know, we're going to be able to learn a lot of new things about what the future should look like based on what we're going through right now.
Jenny Tetzloff is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Director of Integrated Marketing, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The Public Museum is just one of the many amazing cultural resources here in the city of Milwaukee, which we're able to explore through conversations on Lake Effect. Whether it's learning about a new museum exhibition or hearing new music from a local band, we work hard to highlight the many cultural voices here in the city. And the way we're able to do that is through donations from listeners like you. This is our one-day member drive. You can show your support for WUWM by calling 414-227-3210, going to the website wuwm.com/give, or by clicking that big red donate button on the WUWM app. It only takes a minute to help fund hours of listening. And that is today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.